Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
And I'm Dr. Redmond.
And we are back for part two of season two of Mindhunters, the show about, well, how frustrating it is to be in the behavioral sciences unit.
At least this season is really frustrating.
It's fascinating, though. Okay, I was wondering, when we talked about the first season, and when we watched the first season, I was wondering, you know, how much are they going to mythologize these guys? Like, how much are they going to accept John Douglas's tendency towards self-mythologization?
Okay.
And the answer is, they're not. You know?
No. Well, they've got, I mean, I'm sure that in the time that they spend, right, trying to figure out, I mean, this is how I see it. I mean, obviously, Manhunter is the first place, right? So yeah, That's where you go. But there's obviously all of these other people.
Mindhunter. And I've again, talked, that's why it's Mindhunter, called. Mindhunter.
Why I call yeah. it. Yeah. No, no. But, right, so Douglas has written a bunch of books.
Yeah.
And then there's a whole bunch of, like, there's Ressler's book. And then there's Dupuy's book. And then there's the woman, Cindy, I can't remember her last name now.
Yeah.
Sort of the female, one of the first female sort of agents that moved into the BAU.
Yep. BSU.
BSU. And then there's, you know, there are other things I've read, like, I've read other things, but I'm sure that they have read a bunch of these, right?
Oh, I guarantee. I mean, whether or not this is officially licensed and branded based on John Douglas's book, these guys have clearly read everything.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with that completely.
And so, I mean, so that moves them away. And then they have to turn this into a TV drama, series, yeah, into drama, so that you can follow it through when you're trying to figure out what they're trying to do. So I think that, you know, that would take away the mythologizing. As I said, if you read Roger, I think it's Dupuy.
Dupuy, yeah. Roger Dupuy.
His book, right?
Yeah, it's impossible.
Because
to think of it that
maybe
way anymore.
That was where all those pictures were that I was looking for a few minutes ago. And that book is at the library. So
do not worry about that.
No, I'm not going to worry about that. But the thing is that he talks about all of these different, because of course he's running.
Yeah.
He's the boss man, as opposed to
one of the guys working the cases. And yeah.
Yeah, he moved into the boss man position, and and so his take on everything is just a little bit different. And well, so and you put all of these books together, and you can come up with an idea, because you're getting everybody's particular point of view.
Well, I think something that interested me, and where I really, so this is something I, it's going to be weird to accuse the man of this, but bear with me. I have always said that John Douglas has a tendency towards mythologizing himself and, you know, talking up his own involvement, talking up his own brilliance in a way that I have found excessive. And I always thought there was no bigger example of that than how he talks about the Atlanta child murders, where he says in the book, and this is pointedly left out of the show, and that's why I thought, that's where the first time the show has really left one of these things out in a way that makes me think, oh, so they don't really have time for John Douglas's nonsense either, which is what appears in the book is him claiming that he knew that the killer was going to start dumping bodies in the rivers before it actually happened. He claims that he predicted that that was going to start happening before it did, and that he claims to have told people and they didn't listen to him. And I'm like, John, if you had told people, like, I don't care how bad the policing was in Atlanta, if you had, before bodies turned up in the river, thought the bodies were going to start turning up in the river and you should be watching the bridges, they would have done that after the first body was dropped in the river. But as the show depicts, it's not until three bodies have turned up in rivers that they start doing that.
Yeah, except you're wrong about one thing, because what they do is have Holden say, like, when they're watching the news.
Yeah.
Right? They do have Holden say this to Bill, I think, that and maybe it's, I can't remember whether it's in their office, right? Holden says when they have, they talk about the fibers. And that's when Holden says, I think it's Holden who says it, oh, shit. Now he's going to start dumping him in rivers because he wants to get rid of the evidence.
Yes, and what they
okay,
put in,
and then it still takes them, you know, it takes three bodies in the river before they'll buy it.
Yeah, and I'm just saying that had he in real life, you were right that they mention it a little, but had he in real life, and he doesn't do it in the show, gone to the Atlanta PD with that prediction the way he claims he did, they would have started watching the rivers after one body turned up in the river. They wouldn't have waited.
Given everything you know about the Atlanta sort of between the PD, Atlanta PD and their criminal investigation bureau and their, you know, and the time period that this was happening in Atlanta, I'm not so sure. I'm not
convinced. Yeah, your skepticism is well earned. Okay. I'm not going to argue with that.
You know, whether or not he said it to someone important or not, but because you do see this problem, and the chief of police finally says, okay, you've got four weeks. You know, you can do it for four, and then they did it for five. So, of course, they're going to find it at the end of five because they've got to find somebody, right?
And God, what a searing indictment of police work this show is. Just the idea that the scenes where they go and they canvass around the places where the kids lived or the kids hang out, and it turns out that, oh, they never saw a cop.
Well, no, and this is where the racism, I mean, if there's one thing this season is doing, is just stating very upfront, and you can't miss it. It's like almost, it's not a sledgehammer, but you can't miss it. Mm-hmm. That these kids were ignored, the fact that they were being killed because they were black, and nobody bothered doing basic police work.
Yep.
Even though there were known pedophiles in the neighborhoods where these children
there lived. Were ones, like I said, I mean, not only was there one just down the street. This known pedophile just down the street from where these kids live.
That they thought was a ring.
Yeah. Jesus. Well, no, that they knew what, I mean, how many people it was a ring. Cause legally, I don't know the term for how many people have to be trading pictures of kids, naked kids back and forth before it's a pedophile ring. Like, I'm sure there is a number. But I'm sure there's a number that calls it, but it's like they knew of at least a couple of guys who were doing it. So I think, it's safe to call that a pedophile ring, isn't it?
What's interesting, right, is, you know, the fact that all of the photographs of the black children.
Yep.
Had been pulled out from the file.
Yep.
You know, and so, I mean, if there is ever an indictment of racism, and even when you had a black mayor and a black head of the CID or whatever they want to call it, CID.
No, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation and the Public Safety Commissioner was the other one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they're still, these cops didn't go and do what's called basic police work of talking.
Just canvassing the area.
They just didn't even bother.
Oh.
So these women
have had to do everything for the cops, and hell, to, you know, use the show's timeline, help get the FBI involved, and still the cops can't be bothered to care.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, like these women talking about how their kids are being treated disposably, and the show is like, yeah, that's true. Yeah. It's not just a claim these kids were making. These parents were making about how their kids are being treated. That is how they were being treated. Like, it takes that as gospel.
Yeah. They must have had some. Yeah. And it's interesting because, like, I really like the fact that they bring up the idea that there might have been more.
Yes.
But that these women, that, that they, I mean, they put the woman into the one who works in the hotel, right? I mean, yep. You have to make these composites. Of course. How she just says to him, yes, so now you found a black man that you can blame this on, so it's okay.
Yeah.
Now, and the funny thing is at the end, of the season, right? I mean, they put up that he still was only found guilty of those two, right?
Adults.
They have never. Okay, he's in jail, I guess. I don't
oh,
know.
Oh, no, he's in jail still, yes.
Yeah, he's going to be in jail for the rest of his life. But what has happened, like, I'm going, okay, but why didn't you just add this little, because I did go and take a look at some of this after I'd finished, because, I mean, it would appear, first of all, the fiber matches were there in more than one. They found hair. They found the dog hair that was a match, but it wasn't a like you can't be 100% certain.
Sure,
about
with
dog
yeah, no, no. I mean, it's because they didn't have a DNA match to the dog.
No,
they just had similar dog hairs.
No, what happens is that somehow or another, with the dog, the DNA sequence in the dog occurs in about one, I'll read this out to you, 1 out of 100 dogs, right? So that's not going to be enough to convince. And that's partly because you could have dogs with the same parents, even.
Yeah, of course.
You know, a lot of them. And they were only able to test for mitochondrial DNA, which, unlike nuclear DNA, cannot be shown to be unique to one dog. Okay, yeah. That's why the dog hair, but this is in 2007. They've been doing so. In 2007, they were still doing DNA testing, okay? And then they found hairs, and the FBI performed DNA testing on human hairs. And again, right, this is interesting. The mitochondrial DNA sequence eliminates 99.5% of persons by not matching their DNA. The mitochondrial DNA in the hairs would eliminate 98% of African-American persons by not matching their DNA. However, they matched William's DNA and so did not eliminate the possibility that the hairs were his. In other words...
So they couldn't make a solid match on the hair, but they definitely said he wasn't excluded by the hair. And 99.5% of African-American males would be excluded by the hair.
Yeah, they had a 2%.
Okay, so it's 2%. They got it down to 2%. There is a 2% chance, like, he is within the 2% of the African-American male population who
that
this could
matches,
be his hair.
Okay. That matches.
That's
William
pretty
Pien.
Good.
Yeah.
And they didn't have any of that to use in 1981.
No, and they've got all of the, and I'm sure some of this stuff is degraded, but they still had fibers and they still had, so the stuff that they did do. So what has happened though, is yes, he didn't go to trial for the young kids.
Yeah.
But they,
it's
only,
not crazy when they say, it's not crazy when the character says we have enough information to close those cases.
Yeah, like there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There are 6 of them that are, and these are just the child victims, okay?
Yeah, of course.
There are 6 of the child victims that are unresolved. In other words, don't fit.
There was no hair match. There was no.
And one of them, they never found a body because that's undetermined. And then of the men, they closed them all. They closed all one,
all of the men
three,
who were
four,
killed,
five,
and they were all, and they were
and
all
they
confident that
them.
That was him.
They attributed them to Wilson.
Okay.
Yeah. So he was tried and found guilty of 2. Sometimes you have to take what you get, but it's not.
No, it'd be great if they could have made it cut and dry. We know 100% that Wayne Williams did it, but. If in retrospect, like, he was a really good, he was an unbelievably good suspect. The man had contact with so many of the kids. He fit, quote unquote, the profile of the guy. He was, you know, there when somebody was dumped in the water. Like, he was a really good suspect. And I am glad that most of the murders that they pinned on him have been borne out by DNA.
It
Not
looks
all of
like,
them.
Yeah. Yeah, it but looks
most
like
of them murder. Have been, you know, there's a good chance on the DNA. So that makes me very happy.
Yeah. Oh, well, what's really interesting is that, I mean, I can't remember whether it was in the book Mindhunter. Got to keep doing
it. It's easy to do.
Mindhunter,
you're not
the only
one who does it.
In the book, whether he talks about his interview with People magazine.
I don't know.
Douglas. Hmm. Does he talk? I don't remember.
Not that I remember, no.
Because apparently they were just furious.
Oh, really?
That he went and did this thing because I guess the trial was still ongoing. And he went in and said, oh, yeah.
He did it.
And there was no question in his mind.
Well, no, you wouldn't put that in this season because it ends with his arrest. But oh my God, imagine if they do that next year.
Yeah.
And Holden causes a problem by going to People magazine and saying, we're infallible. He definitely did it to People magazine while the trial is happening.
Yeah, apparently he got his wrist slapped really bad.
I would hope.
At work. But what he does say, though, what he did say that there were probably other perpetrators. It wasn't just him.
It wasn't
for
just
all
minor.
Of them. Yeah. But anyway,
people killing kids.
But they all wanted it to be the Klan, and it's an interesting, right? It was interesting how they covered all of that. Like it.
Well, that was incredibly frustrating because you see that they have good reason to think it's the Klan. You know?
Yeah.
Because that's the weird part is the Klan is this, you know, horrible, monstrous organization. These guys hate black people. They would, if they had a chance to kill black people, to do it. They have many times in the past, but oftentimes these guys, you know, just don't want to go to jail. And so you get these frustrating scenes where, like, guys are basically maybe taking, like, a guy is happy to let his brother believe that maybe he killed this black kid because it gives him cred within the racist community.
Yeah.
And the cops come looking for him, but of course they can't prove anything because he actually didn't do it. He's just happy to take responsibility for this murder because it'll give him cred among all the racists. Like, yeah. Damn.
Yeah, and that's rough. It's Luby Jeter. Yeah, that one they attribute to Williams as well.
Yeah. Oh no, and they made that clear in the show. Mm-hmm. And it's very frustrating because you watch the show and it's like, I didn't remember the part of the story where they actually pulled in to a Klan guy. And then you see the way they handle it. I'm like, okay, well, this is why I don't remember that part of the story because it didn't really come to anything, which is too bad because,
It was, well, yeah, and plus it was, you know, I mean, there's, again, right, there's all sorts of stuff. I'm sure that they combed through a lot of files and stuff too to put this together, which is why you have such a gap between season one and season two.
Yeah.
Because they do want to get it at least reasonably right.
Oh, absolutely.
And you know, because and Douglas isn't going to do all of that, and you know, and
neither is any
of the others. You'd have to go get a book on the Atlanta
child murders.
And
well,
would you like to do
something very entertaining on the subject? And we should track this down, because I think it'd be interesting to rewatch. This is a James Woods movie from the, I think, mid-90s. One of those cable HBO movies that I'm going to have to find out the name of. Where the theory of the movie was that the Klan was just doing open warfare on the black community. And the FBI used Wayne Williams, who did just kill the adults, to cover up the rest. This was made in the 90s before the DNA evidence came in, obviously.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was the point of view of the film. So it would be interesting to see how they've dramatized what was the conspiracy theory at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, Atlanta officials criticized the Atlanta child murders film, claiming it distorted the facts of the case.
That might be it.
This film, though, starred Calvin Levels, Morgan Freeman, James Earl Jones, Rip Torn, Jason Robards, Martin Sheen, and Bill Paxton. Yeah, this wasn't for TV.
Actually, you know, this
was for TV. It was.
You know
CBS.
What? James Woods was not in it. It's another movie. I'm thinking about the James Woods movie about the McMartin trial. My bad. That one's on me. Sorry about that.
Because I'll bet you it was 1985. I'll bet you we watched it.
It wouldn't surprise me.
I don't know. In 1985, would I have let you watch this? No. You would have watched it. I would not have.
No, I know I've seen it eventually. I knew I saw it eventually.
Later on, yeah. But 85? Yeah.
Not when it originally aired. Probably not. No. That's a good chance. I was not ready for that one. But anyway, let's focus up on some of the character stuff they do right here at the end.
Okay,
Bill's going. Oh, before, yes.
Okay, yeah, because we're going to talk about what Bill's going through. But the other thing I wanted to, I thought about this after we finished doing the first five episodes, right? And then I thought, okay, now wait a sec. And I mean, because I had this, are they going to go there with the child? Remember?
Yeah.
We talked
about that.
But I thought, and then I'm going, maybe what they're trying to do after you watch the next, well, it's not even, no, because I thought about it before I watched the last four episodes.
Right.
And I thought, well, no, maybe what they're trying to do with him, it is show, just like with Holden, remember when his girlfriend wants to do the role play and he can't do it. He just can't, because it just reminds him too much of his work. And whether they're trying to say that Bill is too involved with his work and understanding where all of these criminals come from to be able to deal with his child and his wife decent, like, you know what I'm trying to say here?
I do.
His work. And he's looking at this, and because they don't know anything about the child's first 3 years.
Yeah. It creates this
doubt in him because of his work, and that doubt isn't. But I'm sorry. But then I went and I watched the next four episodes, and I'm going, well, no, I got to go back to my original sequence, because this kid is way too creepy.
I know.
This kid is way too creepy. Standing there staring at the girl.
I know.
And they want to blame it at the... No, he's been standing there staring at the girl. The mother wants to say this is
normal and like...
Like, and he's not being allowed to play with these children. And that's what the surface... But in my soul, I'm sitting here with Bill going, this kid is awfully... This is awfully, 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 awfully creepy. And now Bill's not handling, like, Bill should be able to handle this better now. But at this point, they still don't know an awful lot, right?
Because they don't know anything about the kid's origin. And they've only done the very most basic research into what creates psychopathic personality.
Yeah. You know, so Bill is worrying, but you don't know whether he's worrying for nothing.
Yeah.
Right. And this is all 79, 80, 81. You know, so you're going, but so they might be trying to do that. That's what they did with Holden in the first season, was just to tell you how the job made him really almost incapable of like dissociating himself from his job.
Yes.
That this stuff is horrible. And I mean, I'm not going to. You think I'm going to trust a Roman Catholic priest? I don't think so.
No. I mean, you reach a certain point of, like, once your eyes have been open to this stuff, it is difficult to close them again. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, people would close them, but when you're working with it constantly, when you're doing it constantly, when you're seeing it constantly, when you're thinking about it constantly, you can't... Mm-hmm. I think take it away, and they can't, because it's their job in a different way, right? I mean, I had to do other things because, well, anyway, that's a whole other story for this. But at the same time, you know, I'm immediately going to be suspicious, and I sometimes look at families, and I'm wondering.
Yep.
I'm going, but thank God, very few of these very, very bad home lives turn into serial killers. But this child has already, it doesn't matter. This child stood there and watched.
Yep.
And no matter, and of course she wants to focus on the fact that he was trying to, you know, bring the child back to life. Well,
yeah.
They, No, no, but, you know, and I can understand, like, her kind of thought processes, but she's not even willing to talk to the child. I mean, if you want to talk about Bill being between a rock and a hard place.
Look at how isolated she has made that child.
Yeah.
Like, they're both, and God, the horrible scene. No, he's not normal.
He's not normal. He didn't talk, for God's sake, when they got him. He refused to go anywhere near Bill. If that isn't an indication that there's abuse, male abuse.
Of course it
is. This child has come from prior to the age of 3, then what else
What could be? Yeah. Well, and I think that the fascinating thing is you totally understand where they're coming from, because the kid's 3 years old and they don't know a ton about child development. So they think we get him in a good home, we treat him well, he'll turn around. And they don't understand that the kind of abuse that happens in brain development when you're that young, when you get horribly abused before age 3, it changes the way your brain is wired. These are when the mental pathways are being created, and you end up in this situation where, like, no, I'm not saying the kid is irretrievably evil. I'm saying it would take the kind of specialist therapy, and he should have been having it since he was 3.
Well, he should have been, they should have been taking, okay. Now, the only thing I'm going to say this too, right? I will bring this up. The only thing I can say is that this is realistic.
Yeah.
This child, okay, he's not talking. And so they don't take it. Nobody takes it as seriously as they should have.
Mm-hmm.
I go back. I always go back to the Nancy Spungen's mother's book, And I Don't Want to Live This Life, where she talks about her child and raising this child and how nobody would take it seriously. She had issues right from the beginning, and probably I get these days, I mean, it sounds a bit like it might be autism of some sort or another.
Yeah.
That this little girl had, and she was also not very nice to her siblings, but nobody looked at this, you know, from a developmental point of view.
Yeah.
And even when I can remember when I sort of read that and I thought, yeah, but you know, maybe you could have done things differently, but the doctors were giving her all this advice
how many people have it within them to stand up to a doctor's advice about your kids?
Not very many.
Not that many.
And then plus,
especially at the time.
Wait. And then there's always the problem of if you don't like what the doctor says, you take him, or her to another doctor.
Oh, that's the worst.
To try and switch this, right? And so it's very complicated back in those days, because the idea of children, remember, I mean, this is when you're getting the bad seed after the bad seed after the bad seed. You know, this whole idea that somehow or another heredity can't be changed and environment isn't the big issue. And then, you know, and then you get the swings to the it's all environment and none of it's heredity. And we're trying to, you know,
to
balance those things. Like, you had these two almost diametrically opposed views, and the idea that somehow or another that if you gave a child, and I mean, maybe this child is just like Bill's child is just, this is a form of autism, but it doesn't strike, knowing what we know now, it doesn't strike us.
No, especially since he was able to, when he got away from whatever abuse he suffered as a young child, he was able to start talking and being happy and playing and interacting normally with other kids to a certain extent, and talking to Bill. If it were just if it was a severe autism, I don't think it would fix itself that well through normal socialization.
It would be doing these days.
Yes. Normal socialization would be doing a great job. No, it does seem like someone suffering from PTSD, like, and how he was being socialized out of it, and this has triggered a relapse.
I think that's
the best way to look at it.
What I still don't know is what happened to those other kids.
Yeah.
The kids that were older.
Who actually did it. Yes.
Yeah.
That's the real question. And they leave that completely up in the air. Obviously, there was a significant enough legal penalty or like going after those other kids, that the mother of the dead kid feels comfortable now coming back and saying she doesn't blame their son.
Yeah. Oh, what a horrible.
What a horrible scene that was.
Oh my God, where she's sitting there and I'm going.
God, that was rough.
Although, I mean, I would have said, and she comes with a nun. Yeah. That's who that woman is.
Yeah.
I think she's not a social worker. I think
this is, you know, religious comfort.
Yeah. And I'm going, I don't know. I'm a different person though.
Yes. That's the thing.
Yeah. I mean, I might have let you come and try and talk to my little boy to tell my little boy it's okay that I have forgiven you.
But she's so, I'm not saying she's delusional, but she wants to move forward like this didn't happen.
Yeah. And well, she is to some extent. And because she thinks she can do that, she is to some extent.
Okay. You're right. I didn't want to be too mean to her.
No, she isn't. Right. I mean, she's not big, like she's not big.
Capital D delusional, but.
But there is a level of, let's just pretend never.
Denial of reality.
Yeah.
It has to go into thinking that. Because her whole idea is this is a thing that happened, but it doesn't have to define his entire life. Well, if you choose not to talk about it and you completely, like, rebuild, like, send him out of the city and do all of that, you are kind of building his whole life around it.
Yeah, yeah. You are making this the most important thing in this child, and you're going to... Bill is right in that sense. That no, we shouldn't be disrupting him. Let's wait till the end of the school year.
Yeah.
She's the one that can't cope with the child, with the place, with all of the, with the neighborhood. I understand it.
You want to get away from where a horror has happened. Like, I'm not blaming her. Well, I am blaming her. I'm not saying her actions are illogical. I'm not saying her actions make no sense, but it doesn't seem like it's the right thing for the kid.
But that's hindsight is 2020. I mean, that is sort of that whole idea was still far and away. Somehow or another, the idea was that if the child doesn't talk about it, the child has forgotten. And therefore, it's going to have no later impact. We now know that that's not the truth.
No.
At the time, it's
understandable where she's coming from.
Plus, Bill is being a friggin' asshole.
Yes, he is.
As far as I'm concerned, we've got here. I'm sorry, Bill, but you should have told everybody.
I know. Oh,
you should
God.
Have told everybody, and you should have taken 6 months off the job. No job. I don't care. You have a child, and okay, so there are 19 dead children in Atlanta. There are a hell of a lot of other people that can deal with those 19 children in dead children in Atlanta.
Jesus You've Christ, got Bill. A child if and you a know woman well, and the thing home. Is, they in the months he's down in Atlanta, because it is this season covers months and months.
Yeah,
he could have spent that time in what do you call it? He could have spent that time in Washington. In Quantico, hiring other people to send down there.
Yeah.
He could have been home every day at 4 o'clock to work with his son, and he could have spent all day hiring people to send back up to Atlanta, but he won't admit it to people.
Yeah, he wouldn't. So he tells, and then our cheerful psychologist or Wendy, keeps the secret. And then when he finally
has to confront Holden with it and it's just so frustrating because he's like, yeah, well, obviously Holden wouldn't have been such a dick to you this whole time if he'd known.
Yeah.
But you're talking to him like he should have known that you've got that your life is falling apart. Will you keep him entirely out of your life, Bill?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, how is anybody, you cannot blame people and you cannot start screaming at people when you haven't told them what the problem is.
Yep.
It's not their fault that you're an asshole in this situation.
Bill is clearly,
as you say, he could have spent that whole time hiring people, training them, sending them down to help. You have got Holden there. You could have sent Wendy down there.
Yep.
You know, I mean. And you could have gone to Gunn and just said, look, I need 6 months and this is the plan. Yeah. I need to stay here. I need to stay with my wife.
I need to work with my wife and my son, and I will do all of, you know, I will get all of the work done here while I'm doing it, but I can't go to Atlanta 4 days a week.
Because she had to move. She had to get permission.
Yep.
From child services, from the court, the whole thing. And she obviously did that. And he still isn't listening to her.
I know.
Well, we'll talk about it. Well, I'm dead tired. I'm going to go to sleep. I'm sorry.
It's frustrating.
I don't blame, like, whatever I can say about her being semi-delusional about that the child is just going to forget this and it's all just going to go away. If he never hits another trigger point, if it nothing might. Ever triggers him again. Okay, then he might have a, you know, he might become sort of like Spencer Reed, you know.
Yes.
You know, focus on schoolwork, become fairly reclusive, not actually having too much empathy or anything like that, because that's Reed's problem. Like, he might become like that, but he might not do any of these horrible things or become any of a horrible person. Yeah. So, I understand, like, it seems like I was being really, really hard on her. But to be like that, to going, what she said, I said this myself. Look, if I have to do the whole friggin' thing on my own, what the hell do I have you?
Yep.
Because you're just making my life even more complicated. Sorry, you know, I mean.
That was true.
You know, he's making her life. She can't even, at least this way, now that she's gone, and he'll find out where she is. But
of course.
But the point is that then she can just, okay, we've got one track and this child will be brought up in this one track and they're going to have the help from the psychiatrist and the psychologist and the rest. And yes, they're not, you know, I mean, they're not totally stupid, even though, again, you see this guy who wants to talk about Manson, right?
Yeah, I know. That's
right. But for the most part, right, what's going to happen is the child is going to get some work done because the court is mandating it and they can't do anything about that. But she, at least the child will only have one set of influences. He's not going to be expecting the child, his father to show up. He's not going to be expecting his father, you know, because there's nothing worse for children of divorce, as you know.
You know, I mean, as every person will tell you, like, if you were constantly being let down by one parent, it's hard to get over that.
Yeah, as I said, I mean, you know, as a child psychologist, but this was already in the 80s, right? Hey, don't make promises you can't keep.
Yeah.
To your child. Don't tell your child you're going to come and pick them up and then not show up.
Yeah, because that is the thing that is the worst. Yeah.
Better not to see your child.
Than to make a commitment you're not going to follow through on.
Yeah, and he's not following through on any of this. You know, his commitment is to his job, not to the child that needs him desperately. His wife needs him and his child needs him. And he's just, poof!
Yeah.
Sorry, my job's more important than anything you guys are going to do.
Yeah. I know, it's very frustrating. And especially when, like, there's, not to criticize the character too much, but there's nothing he does in Atlanta that couldn't have been done by another agent.
That's right. And that's the whole point. But it's this single-minded... You know,
I think it's also a feeling, and maybe I'm reading into this, it's a feeling of possessiveness over, like, so on one level, he feels pressure from Gunn, right? He feels pressure from his boss and from Webster, the head of the FBI.
Yeah.
He feels pressure to prove that the BSU is going to work, right? That it's going to be useful and it's going to accomplish things and it's going to be worth investing his money in, right? And he feels like, if I'm there, I can ensure, like, because ultimately it's my name at the top of the masthead, I need to be there to ensure that this works. But he doesn't understand that if he was just delegating authority better, you know, and letting Holden run it down there. And you know what? I can't keep forgetting what their version of the Judd Ray character's name, Jim?
Jim.
Right? Whatever his name is. But the point is, that guy, Jim, to keep Holden in line and then send in a bunch of backup.
Yeah.
Like, that would be the smart way to do it. Yeah. But he has this commitment where he believes that he is, I mean, I almost want to say indispensable to the...
That's the word I would use, that somehow or another, he's indispensable.
Yeah.
Okay. Where
it's like, no, it's just the program. Like, trust the program. Trust the work you guys have done together to build this program.
Yep.
You know? And he can't do it. And I understand why he can't do it, but it's frustrating to watch.
But it's very... it's obsessive, which led me to think afterwards, well, maybe they're just trying to show... Right, yeah. How obsessive.
Yeah, well, I mean, at the same time...
But at the same time,
I don't know if they're drawing a direct link between him and BTK or anything like that, because that is... The constant check-ins with BTK are our concept of what obsession is in the world of this show. But, you know, they're both family men, you know? They're both family men in the same way who, you know, get snippy about their job. So it would be a reach to say that there's a direct correlation between two, but it's like the only two characters in the show. I don't think it's completely crazy because I think it's notable that the only two characters in the show we check in with who are living in domestic suburbia are Bill and the BTK killer.
Yeah.
I don't think that's accidental. And I'm not saying they're saying he's, you know, on edge to that point, but they do want to remind us that there is this obsession that men have to break out of domestic life.
Well, what happens, no, what you're saying is that BTK is actually handling his two lives
better, yes,
a lot better than Bill Pinch.
Well, I hadn't planned on saying it that way, but now that you've said it, I can't argue that that's essentially the point I was making.
Yeah, I mean that's the point. By the way, the his name is Jim Barney.
Jim Barney. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. But yeah, no. I mean, I wouldn't have made that connection, but you can see it because they do an awful lot of good things here. But the point is, right, because BTK, he's got the wife, he's got the kids, they go to school, mm-hmm. he goes to church, as we all now know, right? Yep. He had this
fully cover, yeah, like this fully realized cover.
And only once in a blue moon. His wife only caught him doing this stuff twice.
Yep.
Right. And we do we see
Well, that's
it,
why we see him go to a hotel at the end of the
Yeah. Thing. So now he goes to a hotel to do his fetish stuff.
Yeah.
To keep him going, right? And mm-hmm. and then he has his murder photographs, Polaroids and stuff mm-hmm. to keep him going, you know, because that is the thing where they're going to have to get to, because as they say, when they've got BTK, that threw a wrench in a whole stack of things.
Their ideas of
these serial killers, right?
Yeah, I mean, just the idea that he could be satisfied with his fantasies for 20 years. And maybe he would have gone back and killed that lady he was... Like, maybe he would have, if they hadn't caught him, gone and killed that lady he had been stalking. I mean, we can't say for sure he didn't get a chance to. But in those 20 years, there's plenty of women he had stalked that he never went back to killing.
No. He never
That's the interesting part. Like, he didn't go back to killing. Yeah. And they had all the documents of these women that he was stalking, this woman that he was stalking, like the woman who they refer to as like BTK's last victim, you know, or last would be victim. But the question is, how many other women in those 20 years did he have a similar file on? And did he spend weeks fantasizing about murdering, but then never did anything.
And he might never have gone through with this one either.
With this later. Exactly.
Right?
And that's interesting about it.
Because
it's like,
you never know. You don't know. And because, of course, now he's going, well, yeah, but, you know, I wasn't. Yeah. Oh, give me a break.
I know.
Yeah. Okay. You know. You know, it's just these guys all, you know, it's like watching Williams there. Right. And you're just going. Yeah. Okay.
We all see your mythologizing. We all see your braggadociousness.
Yeah.
Like, we know who you are.
Well, only if, as I said, if you had this DNA stuff now. And oh, God, you've got all of these fibers and they've been able to check things back and the rest of it. It's an interesting thing, you know. And you also see the development of forensics because, of course, you know, he tells the cop, well, just write down, you know, just keep track of everything that's in the car. Right. And the guy doesn't bag it all and they let the guy go off. Right.
I know.
The cop is just sitting there. Well, you told me to write it all down. I've got it all here. What was in it?
Yeah. Right?
Well, yeah, but I wanted it bagged. I didn't think I'd have to tell. Well, you do.
No, and the thing is, but that's the thing. You say log everything that's in the car.
And he did.
And he did log everything that was in the car, quite literally.
Yeah.
But that's all he did.
Yeah. But this was 1981.
Yep.
You know, I mean, and this was long before we had all these forensic units and everything else, right? Because you can watch early stuff and they don't take any care with this. Like, I'm even watching some Midsummer Murders, right?
Right.
And Midsummer Mysteries or whatever.
Midsummer Murders is what it's called.
Right. That and you watch even some of those early ones, like where you see them, they're not as fussy about when they pick something up, right? They might bag it, but they don't put on the gloves before. It's only under circumstances, right, that they put on gloves and stuff. It's fascinating to see the massive development of the CSI system.
Well, do you know what one of my all-time favorite stories about that is? All right. I think you're gonna find this entertaining. So this is the true story from the Manson murder. It's an unpleasant story, but it is true. So, Tex Watson beat someone so badly with the revolver he brought that the revolver fell apart.
Yeah.
And while leaving the house, he just threw it down the hillside.
Yeah.
The next day, a kid who lived in that house at the bottom of the hillside is playing in his backyard. He sees the gun. And what he does is, he grabs it. He takes a pencil. He's like, I watch Dragnet. I know what to do. He takes a pencil. He puts the pencil down the gun barrel. He carefully lifts it, puts it in a plastic bag, and then tells his parents about it, and they call the police. And the cop gets there, and he just takes the gun out of the bag and starts turning it over in his hands and looking at it. Like, the child knew about Dragnet and how to handle evidence.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but that, and you're right. Like, that stuff just keeps going. Like, these cops don't get the education they need about how to deal with evidence. And as you say, the FBI has so much specified training. And, like, they have specialist training, right? And they make the mistake of assuming everyone knows the things they know. You know what? A lot of smart people make that mistake.
Yeah, well, the thing is you can be smart and there's a whole bunch of things you don't know.
Oh,
because you never studied them, they don't come across your desk, whatever.
But
there's all sorts
of people who know a lot of things can be very self-involved and not understand that not everyone has their frame of reference.
Yeah.
That's totally normal thing.
And these guys are pretty, pretty isolated.
They are. No, they isolate themselves.
Yeah.
Interesting handling. Yeah. And now can we talk about Wendy? Just a self-destructive person in every way.
Holy shit.
What are you doing, Wendy?
Do you not understand? Like, this woman isn't out. How the hell can she be yelling at this
her
woman
girlfriend.
Who has a child at her girlfriend who has a child, but
because she speaks differently to her than she does to her ex-husband and child. FYI, Wendy, if that man tells a Virginia judge that his wife is living with another woman, he can make it so she never gets to see that child again. That's a fact. Like, that's true. And she acts like the woman is a hypocrite who's betraying her supposed belief. No, Wendy, you're using any excuse to not be in a relationship.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I still couldn't believe that she didn't understand. Well, no, you can move into my guest room. Yeah, what?
What is wrong with you?
Well, it's 1981.
I know. But she's so awful about it.
Oh, yeah. She's just awful, awful, awful.
Oh.
I mean, these are really, really, really damaged people.
Yeah.
Across the board, there's one thing.
Where she, like, I know it hurts. I know it hurts that your girlfriend has to pretend the relationship isn't a big deal with her ex-husband, but it's like, this is 1981. There are severe legal ramifications to being openly gay.
Yeah.
Okay? So the idea that she could be so cold to her is,
unbelievable.
Well, no, it is believable. It's just frustrating.
Well, yeah. I mean, given her character, yes, it is believable, right?
Yeah.
But she too, you know, but she doesn't want to face certain things about herself. You thought she was coming more into her own, obviously.
Nope, not so much.
Not so much after you finish the next four episodes.
Yeah, I really thought she was doing better.
Yeah, and the thing is, as you say, any excuse, and any not excuse. Even being willing to talk to her, not even staying there to see what happens and how she's going to get introduced to the son.
Yep.
Nothing. It's not like the girl told her to go home because my son's coming.
Nope.
She just didn't want her husband to see her.
Yep.
You know? And they should have talked about this more anyway. And plus, Wendy is the one that wanted to meet the child right at the beginning.
I know.
Does she have no understanding that it is 100 times worse? Like, she doesn't want anybody at Quantico to know she's a lesbian.
Yep.
So it's 1,000,000 times worse in this, at that period of time. It's 30 years ago.
Yep. Almost 40 years ago.
Almost 40 years ago.
Yep.
Yeah, because it's going to be 20, so 21. 40 mm-hmm. years ago. 40 yeah. years ago. This was unheard of.
Yes, it was.
Except in Doonesbury.
Well, yeah. Well, Doonesbury is always that. They're fighting to move people forward.
And that was fine because she lived in Boston. If that's the way she wanted to live, then stay in Boston.
I know.
Don't move to the FBI, to Quantico. Are you that out of touch with reality? I don't think
so. But it's like this. She's a smart woman. She's aware of what politics are like. And she is aware of the career implications. But it's like, be honest about it, Wendy. That's what's so frustrating, is her trying to offload all of the guilt onto her girlfriend. It's just so terrible.
And she's so abusive. So abusive. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And you're just a bartender.
I know. Jesus Christ.
Off, Wendy.
Yeah. She's a monster in this episode.
Yeah. And these last four episodes.
Yeah, she's in that episode.
She is shown to be a self-involved.
Yeah.
Elitist. We could call her an elitist.
Too. We could call her that as well. But yeah, she's terrible.
She's an ivory tower elitist is what she is. She lives in this and doesn't understand how real people live their lives, clearly.
Well, and God, that look on her face when the boss is like, we don't need you to go and do the interviews. Mm-hmm. And she has to face up. And when is she going to face up to, like, what she's personally is getting out of the interviews?
Yeah.
Like, what is it what is she learning about herself by doing the interviews that she's so desperate to keep them going?
Yeah.
You know, why does she have this compulsion to spend time with these violent men? That's what I'm interested to see if they get deeper into that, because there's obviously something going on there. I mean, and this is something that's going to come up in our reviews of Criminal Minds in a couple of months. Well, for you and I, next year for everybody else. But I really thought they were going to do something interesting with Tara on Criminal Minds, because when she's first introduced, we are introduced to a woman who is so, like, obsessively fascinated, like, and just to the extinction of her own personal life with spending time with serial killers. And that suggests a very interesting character who's got a lot going on, none of which pans out.
Well,
none of which ever goes anywhere.
Now, what's interesting, that may come to the comment that I got from somebody that we'll talk about when we get into that season, just talk about this business of Criminal Minds' non-relationship with anything but heteronormative sexuality.
Yeah.
In its characters.
That is an interesting thing.
And thank you, Jay, for
tipping us off about that.
About something that happened at the beginning, but we'll discuss it much later.
We're going to discuss that a little later.
Although,
it does factor in.
It's interesting because in this episode, right? What have you got? But this, I mean, she's trying to deal with this, but it's, and I'm not sure what we're supposed to make of this, except that as a personal revelation, you know, and she doesn't have the option to tell Warren, hey, I hit for the other team. Whereas her girlfriend, of course, is in the bar and says, I play for the other team.
Yeah.
And that isn't as big a problem in her life working in the bar
as it is for Wendy.
Wendy doesn't want to go to the movies. Wendy doesn't want to go out in public. Wendy doesn't want to have anybody even question. It's a wonder she even goes to that bar.
Yeah, well, that's why, if she can just have this woman living in the same apartment as her without making a real commitment, well, then she won't have to be seen out in public at all with a woman.
Yeah.
She won't have to go to the bar. She won't have to go visit her girlfriend at her girlfriend's apartment and risk being seen going in there. Like, all of her stuff she does is pathological.
Yeah, it's all pathological. And the girlfriend was right.
Oh, yeah. Completely right.
What do you want here? The girlfriend's smarter than Wendy is about Wendy.
Yeah. Oh, no. She knows. Well, because I'm sure she's dealt with closeted women in the past.
Yeah.
You know?
And the thing is, probably in so many ways as gay, like men, also had to deal with closeted married men. She's probably dealt with closeted married women.
Absolutely.
But Wendy probably looked as if it would be different because Wendy's not married.
She's not married. She was, as she said, she was out in Baltimore. Sorry, not in Baltimore. Yeah. She was out in Boston. But, right, she was out in Boston. Like, it's a whole thing.
Although, even that out, like, if you go back to that first season and you get those sort of flashbacks to the relationship with her professor, right? And then her professor, I'm not sure that she says she was out in Boston, but I'm not sure just how out. They probably had a whole bunch of girlfriends, like, who were all lesbians and the rest of it. But there was that scene in the restaurant or in the bar where this woman that she is in a relationship with, you know, is talking to this guy who is clearly doesn't seem to be aware.
Yeah.
She's not. And, you know, the professor is not dissuading this man.
Nope.
Of you know, when he's made. Yeah. Sort
so
of
you're right. There are degrees of being out.
Yeah,
you're
there are degrees. Right. You know, there are degrees of being out. And Wendy was upset by that. She thought about, because we got that flashback in the first season, and now we're getting, you know, this sort of, she's confronted with something that should be a little bit clearer. But I mean, the FBI was a place where you weren't supposed to be married, and you weren't supposed to have another job, and you weren't supposed to, you know.
Yeah, no, your whole life has to be the FBI.
But she's not in the FBI. No. And that's, I think, what Gunn is trying to tell her, the boss is.
Yeah.
Trying to tell, you're not in the FBI. If she wants to be in the FBI, then she can go through the training. And that's why he won't send her into the field and doesn't want her. I mean, he's couching it. He's couching it nicely. And you're the academic and you're the one that has to do this.
You're more useful here reading over the files. But fundamentally, FBI agents don't trust non-FBI agents who haven't gone through the indoctrination.
And she can't go in. She can't go into the field because she does. She hasn't had all of that horrendous training that we see periodically.
Yeah,
that they go through.
Glimpses of.
And you saw it. You know where you saw it of all things is in that show Quantico.
That's true.
You got.
I mean, it is torturous indoctrination in the months and months and months they spend learning to be an FBI agent. For the love of God, the final. If you want to know how much the FBI is like a cult sometimes, the final thing when you get your badge is to get a room full of people holding their badge up in front of them and endlessly reciting the FBI oath over and over again as they stare at their badge.
You know.
Like, if Jim Jones had done that, we'd say it was creepy. But it's what the FBI actually does.
Yes, but with the FBI, of course, it's to the Constitution.
I know, it's to the Constitution instead of to God, but it's still creepy.
Well, no, I'm not saying it isn't creepy, but it does make for a relatively, like, I'm not as hard on the FBI as you are. I mean, no. J. Edgar Hoover was a twit, but
a monster. I agree with you that it is good that there is a structure and a, how shall I put this? A tradition of excellence is how they would describe it.
Okay, but, and also a clear idea of right and wrong.
Yes, that is vitally important.
I mean, listen to us complain. I do not know how many times about what goes on at Criminal Minds.
Yeah.
Because how the hell did some of those people actually get through FBI training?
I know. It's absurd.
It's absurd. You know, so it, I mean, it really, it's interesting watching all of this and watching how they dress and how, you know, there is this structure though. They are in the FBI and there is a right and wrong. Now you might want them to be a little more nuanced sometimes.
I do.
Yes,
but
you do.
But there is there's a value to what they are. You're absolutely right.
And the point is okay, here is the structure. Here is the right and wrong. Here is the law. Let the courts be gentle.
Yeah.
Let the courts take care of being.
We have firm lines.
Yeah. And every now and then, okay, maybe you can slightly cross them. But you see that too. Like, as I said, when I'm watching Midsommar, for the most part, well, when you have the people that you feel sorry for, they usually die or something, you know?
Yeah, I know.
Or they commit suicide or something like that, so you don't have to worry about them. But there is, again, there is the right and wrong. They're cops. They have a code. This is the law. You broke the law. It's up to the courts or the juries or whatever to go. The FBI doesn't. And that's what you see in this season is this whole political pressure that they are constantly fighting.
Yeah, because when it comes right down to it, and this is a fun fact, after they wanted to make sure there was never a J. Edgar Hoover again.
Yeah.
That was their goal. But so what they did was they set it up, and there was something brilliant to this. They set it up so FBI directors would serve for a 10-year term, specifically so that they would never feel beholden to a single president.
Yep.
So that they would be fully independent. That's why it was such a, you know, a scandal, right, to have Donald Trump firing the FBI director and bringing in his own guy. Now, Clinton did the same thing, but it was less of a scandal because the guy was almost at the end of his 10 years and he was embroiled in an ethics scandal.
Yes, which...
Yeah. It wasn't a big ethics scandal, but it was about, you know, misuse of his expense account and charging weird things to the FBI. So it's like, there were reasons. And Bill Clinton wasn't being investigated for anything at the time.
At the time.
That would come later. But it's like, and that's why there was no big deal about Bill Clinton getting rid of his first FBI director. But the whole idea was the FBI director is supposed to be completely independent and say what you will. Was it Louis Free who came on, who Bill Clinton put in? I think.
Oh, okay, let me.
You can check. But it's like, there wasn't really any intimations that putting in Louis, I think it was Louis Free, but I could be wrong. Any intimations that that was a political thing, right? That he felt beholden to Clinton, or that Clinton was doing it to have a sympathetic FBI director. But at the same time, even while the whole point of the FBI is to be independent from the executive branch, even though it's part of the executive branch, the show does a great job of showing you, of demonstrating that, yeah, there was always politics.
Yeah.
You know, there has always been politics, right? And like, you can never escape from it, no matter how hard you try. And
yeah,
oh, that scene with the director and his, you know, I'm a judge and I know bad when I see it. And some kids you just got to put away forever. Oh, damn.
Okay, it was William Sessions that he fired.
Sessions, thank you. It was Sessions he fired.
And then first of all, there was Floyd Clark was acting for July, August, September, so 2 months, 44 days.
And then he put in Louis Free?
And then he put in Louis Free, you were right.
Okay.
And all Louis right. Free was in there for 8 years, and then Robert
Mueller. How on earth
Mueller
did I forget it was, and then Robert Mueller came in, yeah.
Right, and he was there for 12 years.
Yeah, 12 years. Yeah. How on earth did I forget it's William Sessions? He's the man who said winners don't use drugs, which was at the front of every video game in the 1980s. Giant emblem of the U.S. government or the FBI. And like, winners don't use drugs. William Sessions.
Yeah. Well, he was in almost 6 years, but he was under three presidents. Yeah. Reagan, Bush, and Clinton.
Yeah.
Bush won,
the whole idea is by having the 10-year term, you're supposed to be definitely there for at least two presidents.
Mm-hmm.
So you will never feel beholden to anyone. And I mean, that's gone out the window now because America's crumbling. I'm sorry, Americans listening
Stop
to this,
it.
But come on.
Let's get away from politics. Let's stick with
Let's stick with it. Okay, here's one last thing before we wrap this up. Something I noticed that I loved in the first episode and they didn't really keep up for the rest of the season.
Mm-hmm.
That it's something, I don't remember whose book it was in, but someone in one of the books they mentioned that driving in to Quantico, right? You pass the firing range. And so on the way to work, it always sounds like there's a war going on.
Yeah.
And they got that moment in the first episode where Bill's getting out of his car in Quantico and you hear the firing range loud. And then they pointedly, for the rest of the episode, whenever they're up in Gunn's office, from time to time, you'll hear the faint pops in the background. Because even though they're inside, you can never hear it in the basement, obviously, but even though they're inside, even though they're in the nice office of the new head of their unit, you can always hear the warfare outside just a little. And they didn't keep that up in subsequent episodes, and I'm sad. They didn't focus on that as much, but I thought that was a nice little background touch.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah, it's a little fact about the FBI. You can always hear gunfire in that building.
Well, yeah, because they're at Quantico.
There's a firing range right there. Yeah. It's a military training facility.
Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, the FBI's firing range is literally like less than a mile away from them.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's neat. All right. So do we have any predictions for what they're going to do in season 3?
So we're still only in 81 and BTK didn't get caught till 2000, so I've got another 20 years.
We're gonna keep checking in on him.
Yeah. At the beginning or the end. There was one episode they didn't, I think.
Yes.
I mean, that was the funniest.
Didn't in 7 or 8, I think. Yeah, they just didn't check in on him. It's weird.
Yeah, but that was that. I mean, that scene with him in the Kansas University,
I know.
In the photocopier.
I know. How great was that? I will stay here until the Xerox guy arrives.
Yeah. And so then.
What I meant. And I forgot that was because I had watched the first, when I was watching 5, when I talked about that in the last episode, I had forgotten that you hadn't seen it yet because the start of the next episode auto played. So I didn't realize I had watched when we were talking about it, the beginning of episode 6. But yeah, that great scene. And that's why I feel like there's almost their depiction of BTK is a guy who on some level would be okay with getting caught because then he would get credit. Because the man is making sketches, bondage sketches, in a library. The man is, you know, photocopying his poems to the police in a public library. Yeah. Like, if he had forgotten a page there, he would be under arrest now. And it's like, on some level, I'm not saying it's a conscious thing. I'm saying that he is purposefully being riskier than he should.
Well, yeah, but I think he doesn't. Like, I'm not so, let's just wait and see what they continue.
We'll see how their take on the next season.
Because you haven't, you still haven't read Douglas's BTK book.
No, I haven't read the BTK book. No,
and I've read the BTK book, and I've read some of the daughter and the rest of it's.
Yeah, her book.
It's so sad. Like, I wouldn't want to be her in a million years to have to kind of juggle that. I mean, his son just said, fuck you, Dad. And his, you know, you are no longer my father. I don't want you anywhere near me. Yeah, just completely cut him off, as did the wife.
Yeah.
But the daughter has always had this.
Had a more complicated relationship.
Well, she was younger and he was probably, you know, it's.
Well, no, I mean, we talked about it in the Rebecca Locke character on season six. Like, it's clear what that was patterned after.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the complicated relationship this woman has with her father.
Yeah. And, oh,
especially
be...
since they used her DNA to catch him.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and they're going to have, we're in BTK territory.
Now.
There is going to be a show on, I can't remember what it's called now. It's going to start in the fall. So in September, about the father is in jail and is a serial killer. I think he's a murderer and he's in jail and he's got this son. Can't remember what it's called.
Okay.
And it's really weird. It's weird. I haven't been paying too much attention to it. I may not find out what it was called
and we'll put it in the show notes for this episode on the Podbean page so that people can know where it is. Yeah, because that'll be fun for people to check out, especially if it's influenced by these issues. So my personal prediction, I predicted this last year and I was wrong. So hopefully I'm right this year, is they go back and now that we've got this great idea who the characters are and the thing is bigger and they've had their first real success, even though, as we talked about in the show, how much of a success was it really? But they've had their first real public success at the end of this season, right? So I suspect that next year is going to do the Green River Killer stuff. I think they're going to address that. Because it's like they went to Atlanta and they quote-unquote solved the crime and the city was finally able to kind of relax. Like, it's a very, like, satisfying place. I mean, obviously the characters are all, you know, messes at the end of the season, but the point is, for the overall project of profiling in the BSU, it's a good place to wrap up. And if they do a third season, which I think they absolutely should, because this was really good, I think the way you take it next is you do the Green River Killer and them going and they're doing all of these things and they're focus on the one guy who seems like he should be the killer and the conversations with Ted Bundy about who the Green River Killer is and what he wants and what his behavior is going to be. And the fact that ironically, when they actually caught Gary Ridgway, he's like, yeah, a lot of what Ted Bundy said about me was dead on. Didn't help them catch him, but Ted Bundy was right about him.
Yeah, that's the real problem sometimes, and as they say, when you listen to profiles, like some of them, even as it when Ted Bundy is saying, because he knows, right? But it doesn't help you in a world, even in a world that's just the West Coast.
Yeah, how are you going to find this guy based on that?
Based on that, how do you? You know, how do you refine it even down?
How do you refine it down when all of Portland, half of Portland are men, you know?
Well, and you've got, you know, so you've got truck drivers and things like that. As I said, and they keep catching more and more now, but every now and then. And there's names that, it's funny, to figure out which ones catch people's imaginations and which ones don't. Like, and they talked to a couple of people already this season who you're just going, oh, who are those?
Who is that guy?
Yeah, who are those guys? They're not the ones that make the popular. It's the really bizarre ones that make the that create this mythology, or the nice
stick in people's heads. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and Ted Bundy. I mean, the very fact that he also managed for years and years and years to keep two lives going.
I'm not that many years. I mean, weird part about Ted Bundy is he didn't actually have the kind 20, of really long killing spree. But for years he did, but then he crumbled really hard. And he did, and you talk about the two lives thing where, like, literally, this is a man who people kept reporting him as a suspect in these crimes, and the police would dismiss him because he's a nice white boy who's in law school.
Well, not only is he in law school, but then, of course, he was politically and
yeah, he was politically active in Republican politics. He was like, he's in law school. He's got a fiance. How could he be the guy who's doing all these horrible murders?
Yeah.
Like, because they have these assumptions. And you're right that he was really great at keeping the double life going. And they'll be able to talk. I mean, the show will get into that, I assume, if they do the Green River Killer season.
Yeah. Well, because I would assume they have. I think they, because that was one of the longest running ones. Plus, it's an important one in Mindhunter, and it's an important,
especially
one
because
for Douglas.
The man almost dies.
Yeah, because he becomes so obsessed. Because that is what you see. So maybe we will get Green River Killer next
in
time, because
three.
We are building up this idea of these guys becoming so obsessed with these jobs. Yeah. That they can't.
Destroys their own lives.
They destroy their own lives in different ways. Even she does.
All three of the characters had. Like, his health is at risk. She ruins his relationship. And he's completely disconnected. Her relationship. He's completely disconnected himself from his family. At the end of this season.
Yeah.
The one thing that doesn't pay off in the last four episodes. Everything else did.
Yeah.
Holden's anxiety disorder never pays off in the last four episodes.
No. No, it doesn't. All of a sudden, he doesn't have it really anymore.
I guess we have to assume he's doped up this whole time.
Well, maybe
he's just on Xanax all the time.
No. He would be on Valium. And the thing is that you could, I mean, as long as he doesn't overdose it, like you take a Valium and you don't do an awful lot, if it's just to take the edge off.
Yeah. And as long as he's not drinking with the drinking alcohol with the Valium.
Well,
it's
like he's drinking a lot. So.
Actually, yeah, he is also drinking a lot.
I suspect he's not on the Valium. I think, and that's the thing. I wonder if they're ever going to deal with sort of this alcohol.
How many of these guys turn to alcohol to deal with it? Yeah.
Well, cops do all the time, right?
Obviously, yeah. I mean, that's an integral part of that narrative.
And then in later years, they just turn to drugs to cope.
Yeah. And that's the thing that's going to interest me. Like, I, that's the only thing. Like, this is a very well put together season. I think we can agree all the character stuff really works. The plotting, like, feels really true to the Atlanta child killer story. And the one thing I feel like stands out is what a big deal in the first two episodes they make of his anxiety disorder and the fact that he's going to be on Valium and all of that. It seems like they're setting up something that never pays off.
Okay, here's what happens, okay? Because still remember, we're talking 79, 80, 81. I mean, I was even surprised they called it an anxiety disorder, right?
Yeah.
I'm going, that way back then?
There's actually
40
a couple of
ago?
Terms. There's actually a couple
ago,
of
I'm
terms
going,
in the show where I'm like, that's too modern a term to be using.
You know, and now I'm going, okay, and 40 years later, now children have anxiety disorders. You know, I mean, Lord Almighty, I mean, nobody would have ever said to me, anxiety disorder or, you know, no. I mean, so like, I found that a strange term to use, but what I would say about someone like Holden, and that's why that, and it doesn't pay off because you see him having it and then he probably does do the exercise and he probably is doing more control and he's probably falling back on alcohol to sleep, because that would be a more norm. And he's going, I don't want necessarily the pills after he got through those first few. And he did remember, he got through the interview again with Kemper.
Yep.
He sat there with Kemper, and then he got through the interview with Manson and the rest of it. So
at some level, he might feel like he's conquered it.
He's conquering it. He's getting through okay. it. He's functioning well in his job, and you can, and that's okay. So, and that's where if they do the Green River Killer and his collapse, that's where you'll get the
this
payoff.
This is going to pay off. Yeah,
this
you're
will
right.
Pay off next season.
You're right. I think you're completely right.
And
we
just probably
have to wait next year.
Yeah, and we'll probably have to wait for like
a couple of years for
another
that one.
Year and a half for season three.
Yeah,
and, but I don't care. I mean,
No, it's good. And we're there whenever it shows up.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the, there was one other thing. Oh, and before we sign off, can I just say, how great was the thuddingly obvious, symbolism of him having to do a Passion of the Christ run through the hot streets of Atlanta carrying a cross. We get it, okay?
No, that was so funny, them having to put together the friggin' cross, and then he has to run to get there before the and then he has to set it up right, and then he's just standing there, and I'm just like, oh my God.
I just love, the image of, like, the black church, the giant column of black people, and one white guy in a suit standing next to a cross.
With a white, standing next to the white cross that he put together. Right?
Beautiful white cross that he constructed. We get it.
No, I thought that.
It was beautiful. It was beautiful.
I thought,
I'm not criticizing it.
And no, and we all know how much I criticize some of those things. And this time, though, I don't. Because what it is, you are watching these people destroying themselves for their job.
Absolutely.
And
like, the metaphor works. I'm laughing, but it does work.
No, it was as you watch
it was
good. You just go, is he going to make it on time? Like, I wasn't even sure he was going to necessarily make it.
No, it's a very well edited scene.
Plus, he didn't get to screw the pin in, the bottom pin in. So, but we didn't see it fall down. So that's okay.
No, we didn't.
So stand up on its own. Anyway, and my final sign, it was worth waiting for season two. It's season one was good, but this one's better.
It's a lot better. It really is. Okay, so I guess that's that. Thank you for joining us on this special two-part journey through season two of Mindhunter. We are back this Thursday with either the last episode about season four or close to it. Did we just... I was checking what just went up. I think Omnivore just went up? Or is Omnivore going up this week?
No, just a minute.
She's checking for me. Yeah. While she's doing that, I want to let you know that if you have any questions for us, if you have any comments, if you have any suggestions for other profiling-related fiction, like Mindhunter, although this is docudrama, that you think we should check out, we would love to hear from you. You can drop us a line at profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com. We love learning new facts about this stuff and watching new things within this genre. So reach out to us there, and we will be sure to check out the stuff you recommend.
Okay, so it was episode 35, The Big Wheel Roadkill Amplification was the last one that went up.
Oh, so maybe we've already had Omnivore.
Yeah, Omnivore was on August 1st.
Oh, okay. Omnivore was ages ago. Okay.
Yeah. And
so this is not hit and run. Hell and back?
Just a minute. The only way to do it is to just go, okay, so we just did 35 and then we did the bonus episode. So after the first bonus episode, 36 is going to go up. Where's 36? Oh, it's on the other page.
I am delighted by this, by the way.
That I'm doing all of this. Yes, yes. Yeah. Okay. 36 is to hell and back.
Okay.
Okay. Right. Then we're
so
going
that means
to,
you
then
just
we're going to do 8mm episode 37.
Oh my God.
So
this is so exciting.
This one.
after this airs. You've already seen heard us do Hell and Back, and I'm sorry that we wasted your time debating that. You've already seen Hell and Back, which means on this Thursday, right after this episode airs, you're going to get to hear us talking about 8mm, one of the best movies.
Well, it's every single time I watch that movie.
You don't have to spoil it for them now. They're going to hear you on Thursday. Talking about Gone Baby Gone and 8mm.
Yeah.
Two of our favorite crime thrillers that have just a ton to talk about.
Yeah.
And you are going to have a chance to hear us talk about that this Thursday. So we will see you there. But until then, I just want to thank you for listening and say au revoir.
And until Thursday.
Profiling Criminal Minds is a member of the Kinks Podcasting Network.